Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
The Olympic hockey match between Canada and the U.S. was watched on TV by an unprecedented number of Canadians. Likely, the greatest number of them were familiar with each player, the professional teams they played for, their goal-scoring records, and many other details. Yet the same people would say that the conflict in Palestine is too complex and overwhelming to understand. To try and make current events in Palestine and their context easier to grasp, I'm joined by Mordecai Breenberg of the Canada-Palestine Support Network, CanPalNet, and of course a member of the Red Eye Collective. Good morning, Mordecai.
Good morning, Lorraine.
Is there a starting point where we could get a handle on the Palestine conflict?
I think there's a Palestine story that is fairly clear and but not well known. It's not the dominant narrative, I guess, in postmodern language that we come across. Palestine, the first thing to grasp is that Palestine was a single country. In 1947, the United Nations, dominated by the United States at that time, early on, decided that it would divide this one country into two parts. And 35% of the people living in this one country were Jewish. They were given 55% of the land. The indigenous Palestinian population, which was 65%, was given 45% of the land. It's also interesting to note that the 35% who were Jewish had purchased only 2% of the land that they actually owned. Now, after this division, which was unequal in and of itself, the Jewish state called Israel uprooted and dispossessed 750,000 indigenous Palestinian people who were living there, drove them out to become refugees. They leveled the villages where they had lived and erased their names from the geographical map. So now we have not only the uprooting and dispossession of this very, very large number of human beings, but the Israelis also moved from having 65% of the land to having 78% of the land. Then in 1967, the armies invaded the remaining 22% of this historic one nation, one country, Palestine, and conquered that. And so here we see a constant growth of a small number of people taking over more and more land and dispossessing of the land and driving into refugee status a vast number of people. That is the essential, simple, but accurate story of Palestine.
Now, we've heard much in recent years about the Oslo peace process. What is the Oslo peace process?
To understand Oslo, we first, I think, have to go back to the U.S. War against Iraq in 1991. To form a coalition against Iraq, the Americans secretly made promises to the various Arab client regimes in the region that after the end of the war against Iraq, they would address and resolve the injustices done to the Palestinian people. So at the end of the war, there was something which people have now forgotten called the Madrid Conference, called European countries were participating in it, the Palestinians, the Israelis, various other Arab countries. And it was based on a series of United Nations resolutions calling for an end to Israel's occupation, calling for the right of return of refugees, and so on. The Israelis were not interested, nor were the Americans really in this conference succeeding. And in 1993, in Norway, the Israelis engaged in secret negotiations with Arafat, who was desperate to get some kind of legitimacy. And they came through this secret process in which the Palestinians were not involved. The Israeli government and the American government tacitly were well involved. An agreement called Oslo. And Oslo was supposedly to address again the question of Israeli occupation of the 22% it had conquered in 1967. Many people at the time that Oslo was announced said, this is not a genuine agreement, and this is not going to resolve the issues, and that, in fact, it's an effort to create Arafat as a client state for the Israelis. But nonetheless, Oslo came out of secret negotiations to undercut European involvement, who were much more in favor of an end to the occupation, and to undercut the Palestinian forces, voices which were in favor also of a genuine peace agreement.
So what has happened to Oslo since that time?
What has mainly happened to Oslo is that we had... in Israel, three Israeli prime ministers who were actually opposed to Oslo when it was negotiated. And they were Benjamin Netanyahu, Ehud Barak, and now Ariel Sharon. And each of them has done their best to sabotage that agreement. Basically what that means is that they have increased and doubled the settlements of Jews in this 22% of land they conquered in 67. They have further divided and isolated the various Palestinian homes and residences in villages and in towns. They've set up innumerably more checkpoints that inhibit people from traveling to work, to hospitals, etc. They've intensified the humiliation of the population. The economic situation of the Palestinian people has declined enormously since this so-called Oslo peace process was in process. Now, the Israelis have put forward with the Americans the what one Israeli commentator called recently in the Israeli press the big lie, which was that the Israelis were offering everything and it was the Palestinians who refused. Now, that big lie put out by the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak seemed to carry a great deal of credibility with the Israeli public and internationally, and of course was repeated in the pro-Israeli press that we're subjected to here in North America, Canada and the U.S. indistinguishably. And until in the last year, a number of Americans who were involved directly in the negotiations, as well as Israelis who were involved directly in the negotiations, began writing books with the diaries of the process. And it became quite clear that Ehud Barak was not offering what was anywhere close to a resolution of the issue. And in fact, we've come to the point where a major reserve army major general in Israel called Daniel Rothschild, who was very much in favor, a close supporter of Barak, and very much in favor of the Oslo process, said just in the Israeli press in the last 2 weeks, if Oslo is dead, we were the ones that killed it.
So that brings us more or less to the present, and I guess to the question of what Sharon's strategy is now. If it's not Oslo, what's he up to? What's he after?
Well, Sharon, from the moment Oslo was signed, encouraged people to oppose it, and he was very opposed. He's opposed because he has this objective, which he's had since Lebanon, and he tried in Lebanon and it failed, which is to destroy Arafat, possibly to kill him, and the Palestinian, any organized Palestinian representation, and to drive out further, to dispossess further from the West Bank and from Gaza, the Palestinian population that's there, and to make it parallel to what happened in 1948. He tried this in Lebanon, and the obstacles that he encountered in Lebanon were that the Palestinian resistance and capacity of struggle was far greater than anticipated. The cost to the Israelis' military were greater than they anticipated. And that in turn caused a political dissension inside Israel, so that popular opinion began to turn against this objective. And Ariel Sharon, in that situation, escalated, and that's why we had Sabra and Shatila. Faced with an impasse, he is a man who goes for escalation to get out of the impasse. In the case of the current strategy, He came to power promising the Jewish Israeli population that he would provide them with security and with peace. People may not have believed him about peace, but they thought he would definitely provide them with security. He has provided less security. The life of the Jewish Israeli inside Israel and the settlers in particular now is less secure than it has ever been. So in that sense, his military too has encountered much more resistance from the Palestinians and much more capable resistance. One thing to remember, I think, is when a society develops a culture of racism, which Israel is imbued with, and Sharon represents to the epitome, they think of their opponents as lacking both skill and moral capacity, and they continuously underestimate the human qualities of their opponent. So Sharon is faced with an escalating resistance. He's faced also, as a result of that, with a very quickly multiplying dissent in Israel. The latest opinion polls show that Sharon, who had, like George Bush, more than 80% approval previously, has less than 50% approval now. More seriously than the general public disaffection with his policy or lack of confidence in it is the opposition to serving in the military by officers and other reserve, high-ranking officers and lower-ranking officers in the reserve military. These are essential to the effectiveness of the Israeli military. About 200 officers a month ago issued a statement saying Sharon was a war criminal and they refused to carry out war crimes in the territories. And they refused to sacrifice their lives for settlers who they believed ultimately would have to be withdrawn anyway. That sparked larger popular demonstrations. The opposition to Sharon's policy has been quiescent for the time since his election, but now there are demonstrations of 20,000 people in Tel Aviv, quite significant. About 30% of Israeli people support, in opinion polls, the reserve officers' refusal to go in and do their military duty in the West Bank and Gaza. So, once more, we see Sharon escalating. Now, something that might be mind-boggling to people who don't fully understand the nature of Israeli society in the military caste and political elite. The Israeli press reported that one of the commanding officers, a general, of the Israeli army in the occupied territories about 2 weeks ago said, "We have to study how the Nazis did it to the Warsaw Ghetto." And in fact, it was a very prescient statement because what we see today are the attacks on the refugee camps, which are nothing more than miserable ghettos, 18,000, 20,000 people in Balada camp and Jenin camp. And the Israelis are moving in with tanks. And to avoid street fighting in these alleyways, which they know they're very vulnerable to, they're adopting a tactic of knocking down a wall of a house, just simply shooting at everybody in and trying to go from house to house with the protection of these buildings to go to what they say are the people. They said that the commanding officer issued a statement saying, "We want to kill the people who are standing up and shooting against us." That is, we want to destroy all resistance. So we see this escalation. Now, within the West Bank and the current parameters, I don't think this escalation will get Sharon out of his impasse, but they are certainly a sign of the quandary within which his policy and the dead end within which his policy and objectives find themselves.
Well, it's quite a shocking situation. What about the new Saudi peace plan?
Within the last couple of weeks, there's been these stories of a Saudi police peace plan. I said police plan. Maybe that's what it is. But on the surface, it sounds very positive. The Saudis are putting forward what the United Nations has called for since 1967, that the Israelis withdraw completely from the occupied territories, which means settlers and so on. And in turn, the Saudis say that they would make an effort to get the other Arab governments to recognize Israel. Now, this leaves aside the question of the return of these millions of refugees who've been dispossessed. It leaves aside the question of the fate of Jerusalem and so on. So there are many ambiguities in it. But more important is to look how this so-called Saudi plan was formed. It was first floated in the New York Times by Thomas Friedman, a man very close to the U.S. State Department. And then he went to visit the Crown Prince Abdullah and said, this would be a good idea if you put it forward. And the Crown Prince said to him, according to Thomas Friedman's reporting later, well, yes, it would. And in fact, I have this suggestion in my drawer right now. So, I mean, the whole thing is a kind of a bit of a charade. Now, what I think it is, and this is speculative on my part, is it's a ploy to divert attention from two things. Ploy to divert attention from the impasse within which Sharon finds himself. And secondly, I think it's part of an effort of the Americans who are intent on making a second war against Iraq as part of their so-called axis of evil and their permanent the policy of making permanent wars, ongoing, endless wars, that they want to try and diffuse the Palestinian issue, which is such a great threat to the various client Arab regimes. They would like to have support once more their attack on Iraq. And I think Sharon and the Israeli supporters within the American administration, high-ranking people like Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, and others who are at the center of American policymaking, are hopeful that the war launched against Iraq will provide a cover for Sharon to get beyond his current impasse and undoubtedly create a still wider impasse and greater horror story than present.
So, Mordecai, what do you think we can do here? What should Canadians be focusing on in this situation?
I think what we can focus on is that because Sharon is at an impasse, because the issue of withdrawal from the occupied territories is the key current issue, that we should be pressuring our government to demand of the Israelis that they completely withdraw from the West Bank. This is the only step that can lead to any process of genuine negotiation over the resolution of other issues and establish a basis for reconciliation and a positive development, both for obviously the Palestinian people, but nonetheless also true for Jewish Israelis. So I think we should be pressuring for an immediate end to the occupation. There's a vigil today at Georgia in Granville from 12 to 1, exactly calling for that. And I think we also need to oppose vigorously the war plans of the Americans in Iraq, because this would be another way to just perpetuate the Palestinian tragedy as well as to create even deeper tragedies for many more people in that part of the world.
Thanks, Mordecai, and thanks for coming in to help us try and sort out the stories and look at this issue clearly. I've been speaking with Mordecai Breenberg. Mordecai is a member of the Canada-Palestine Support Network, or CanPalNet. And to contact them, you go to their webpage at canpalnet.ca.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.